Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the internet. Hugh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon. Okay, well, this afternoon, Wavelength is speaking to Hugh. Shall we say where you are, Hugh? Whereabouts are you located?
In Bow, East London.
Bow in East London. Okay, well, today's programme, I'm sort of, it's a bit like a kind of an experimental rehearsal with you. I'm, as you know, I'm making a film sort of based loosely around you and your invention.
Oh, yes.
Which will remain sort of couched in mystery for the time being.
Right.
And part of the film, perhaps the beginning of the film, the first 15 or 20 minutes or so, will include a voiceover. I mean, you know what I mean by a voiceover in a film?
Yeah.
Sort of voice off screen, which might be my voice. And it will consist of a sort of text which I've composed, which is sort of ostensibly about you and when we first met. So it might seem a bit strange, but I quite like the idea of doing this sort of one step removed. In other words, by doing it on the telephone like this, instead of just doing it dead in a studio. You know what I mean? If I'm just reading this out in a studio and sort of looking at a wall or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It somehow changes the sort of dynamic. And furthermore, it's kind of, it makes it more interesting because we're talking about you sort of in the third person, but I am now talking to you. So for you, it'll be a bit strange. It'll be a bit like sort of imagining a film about yourself.
Right.
You can interject at any time. I've got about 20 or so statements which are sort of about you. And, you know, if it, in between, you can intervene if you like.
Yeah.
I'll start. In 1984, Morris encountered someone on the street who was in need of work.
Yes.
He had met this person before.
Yes.
I said we could use a washer-up at the dining room.
Right. Yep.
A few days later, Hugh arrived.
Yes.
This was Hugh's first job since leaving art school.
No, it wasn't, no.
Ah. Okay.
It was my umpteenth job, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. Perhaps I mean that it was your first consistent job.
I don't know about that. Working for you?
Yeah. I mean, because you worked for us longer, I think, than any other job you've ever had in your life.
Oh, dear. What's this leading up to?
No, nothing at all. That's it. I mean,
Yes, I did work for you for quite a long time, didn't I?
Yeah. And
you may be right. That's interesting, actually.
Good. Well, it's caught you off guard somewhat.
Yeah, a bit.
Could you give me an example of one other job you had?
Oh, dear me. No, I used to do office cleaning.
Okay.
But you
had been an art student, hadn't you?
Well, I had been, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty useless, actually.
Okay. All right. My next piece. He was living in a hostel near to Tower Bridge.
Right, yes.
And in actual fact, even as I say that, I think that's not quite true, because I think the first time you were actually living in a hostel down Commercial Road, weren't you?
Further away. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember. I mean, it was a
Tower Bridge, then the second place.
Yeah.
That I moved to afterwards. Yeah.
The first hostel was some vast sort of Victorian-looking, rather a grim-looking place. I seem to remember with thousands.
Yes, it was a Methodist establishment.
Yeah.
I was there for a while, 3 years or so.
Yeah, and it seemed to have like hundreds of rooms and tiny windows and so on.
The windows were quite large, actually.
Oh, okay.
It probably had a better sort of window
aspect.
Yes, than modern buildings.
Oh, right, okay.
So, very bad, apparently.
So mine is obviously a false, can't get enough, a false memory I have of the place.
Sun, if it's vitamin C, or is it vitamin D, I don't know.
Right, right. Do you think you were happy there?
Oh, it was all, yes, it was okay, yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, going a bit further back in time, Hugh's father had worked in a bank, and for a while the family lived well in St. James's Square.
No. Oh, dear me. No, not St. James's Square. It was in central London.
Yeah.
Charles II Street, actually.
Yeah, but isn't that St. James's Square?
Oh, hang on. Yes, I suppose it is. well, it's sort of near Regent Street.
Yeah, but it's the one below, Jermyn Street?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
When you go down from Jermyn Street towards the Mall.
That's right, yeah.
There's a square there. That's St. James's Square.
Yeah, that's right, yes. So yeah. It was off that.
Okay.
It goes across it, east to west, I think.
Right. And you lived there. You must have lived quite well there.
Well, it was nothing special. It was just an ordinary flat, you know.
Uh-huh.
Areas of London probably it might even have been a bit shabby.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, it was just sort of right in the centre, you know.
Yeah.
But
that's strange because
I think now, or it later became probably much more gentrified.
Right. Okay.
But then it was probably nothing special, you know.
But your father what position did he have in the bank?
Oh, it was nothing special. I mean, I don't know. I think he started off as somebody in foreign banking because he had good modern languages, you see.
Okay.
And but later on, I mean, he didn't do that. But then, after an interlude of several years, he went back to it, I think.
Okay. All right. Next statement. Now, this one's a bit contentious. You can argue with this if you like.
Yeah.
And you might want to. His parents, unable to cope with Hugh, found him a place in a remedial school.
That's completely untrue.
This was followed by art school in Farnham.
No. Farnham. That's true. No, I didn't end up in a remedial school, will you?
I thought they placed you in a remedial school.
No.
No?
I was taken into care because my parents separated.
Yeah.
That's all. I mean, it was just ordinary. I mean, Michael Gove, I think, ended up in something like that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's nothing.
It wasn't a remedial place.
But isn't it for people who can be hyper intelligent, but who for one reason or another have fallen behind with their academic?
Well, actually, there's something in that. Yes.
Right.
I suppose. This is all getting rather personal, you know.
Indeed.
You didn't tell me you were going to ask me this question.
It's a film about you, Hugh.
Oh, right, all right.
Okay, I'll move on quickly from that then.
Yeah.
But
I don't mind. I don't mind you asking me, you know.
But could we agree that the school was, there were difficulties, shall we say? Do you think you were a difficult pupil?
Well, I probably was in the ordinary school that I went to, because if I hadn't been, they wouldn't have sent me to the special place.
Exactly.
But, I mean, it was actually highly regarded, and it took children from local authorities right across the country.
Yeah.
It was run in an imaginative way. I mean, it was
okay.
It wasn't terribly strict, you know. And
sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know whether that kind of experiment in schooling is carried on in other places, but it. I think it closed down sort of in the probably in the early 70s.
Right. Well, I might have to amend this text then. You can help me edit it at some later point. I think it is fair to say that the school was not quite your regular school.
No, it wasn't. No, it was a residential school.
Right.
It wasn't large, probably about...
So when you say you were taken into care, who was looking after you then?
No, well, I was in care for a time with about two or three sets of foster parents.
Right.
And then I went to...
But your parents were still alive at this time, so...
Oh, yes.
So
they divorced.
Right. And neither of them could look after you?
Well, no, they couldn't really. I mean, they were... that wouldn't have been... But they did keep in touch with me. I mean, I saw them frequently, you know, they'd...
All right.
It's not as if...
Okay, well, moving on. He became a zealous Catholic, wearing a cross under his shirt and a long strip of leather wound around his arm.
No, I did.
You did. I've seen it.
No. I.
What is that thing that the Catholics? You'd have this strip of leather, and it was wound twice all the way down your arm.
I think that is for people who apply to themselves some kind of painful. I think Opus Dei.
Yeah.
Use such devices, but
you had one.
Nothing like that. No, I just wore a scapular. I still wear it, actually.
Well, what do you call a scapular?
Well, that is simply a piece of brown cloth over the chest and hanging down the back, and they're attached by a lace.
Yeah.
Over the, it's like a loop.
Yeah.
Which you put on over your head, you see, and on the front there's a small piece of cloth.
Okay.
And on the back there's another piece of cloth, and it's a.
All right. Next statement.
Yeah.
Hugh and Morris conversed at length about technical matters: motorcycles, radios, valve equipment, and heated clothing. The two of them seated behind the counter of the dining room, their voices rising up in competition. Hugh's voice asserting by volume in between puffs on a roll-up.
Right. Oh, yeah, we did used to chat about, but I mean, he used to talk to you as well, didn't he?
Oh, yes, there's nothing wrong with that. The two of you would talk for hours about technical things.
He was an interesting person to talk to, of course.
Yeah, but you got on well with him.
Yeah, he was fine. He was rather... Yeah, you had to be careful with him because he was quite touchy about certain things. And but that was
okay. Over the years, Hugh paid in installments for various items of antiquated valve equipment from Morris, and the tiny room at the hostel filled up with a bespoke sound system and rare religious books.
Well, hang on. All I had from him was a sort of 1960s radiogram, the working parts of which I took out of the case.
Yeah.
Didn't
you buy...
That was it, really. So because it was taking up rather a lot of room, and I separated the various parts just for convenience.
What about the Lerveropter?
No, I didn't. That was a temptation... But it would have been very expensive.
Yes, I mean, they always were, weren't they?
They would have probably wanted about £20 for it, whereas I think he wanted £400.
Right.
It was just ridiculous.
And what was a Ferrograph tape recorder?
Hang on, William. I'm just going to say something to somebody. I won't be a moment. Could you get some milk and a paper and get some bread for yourself? Sorry. Okay.
That's all right. Who's that?
Oh, that was Sue. She was just going out to Tesco's.
Right. Fair enough. And what about the Ferrograph tape recorder?
Oh, well, that had nothing to do with Morris.
All right.
I knew about them, but...
Okay, the next...
I got that from a junk shop in where was it from? In Camberwell, I think.
Right. The dining room became their sanctuary for 10 years.
It was what?
A sanctuary.
Oh, well, if you like.
All right.
Yeah. No, it was a nice place to work, you know. I mean, it was fine.
Yeah. All right. Next statement. Hugh had been reading various Catholic journals about Padre Pio, an Australian mystic called the Little Pebble, and most recently the Grass Cross in Eisenberg, Austria, a supposed miracle first encountered by Aloysia Lex on her rural property. Looking up from the suds, Hugh exclaimed loudly, "We could make a film about the Grass Cross."
Yes, that's true, yes.
Yes. All right.
And we nearly did, but we went out there and got material. We stayed there a week, and we took Morris with us because he's a German speaker.
Yeah.
German. And we got quite a lot of material, but we didn't manage to finish the film because we ran out of money. I produced with some...
Yeah, I'm going to move on, Hugh.
Oh, sorry. Is that all you want me to say about that?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. You're in agreement about that one. Okay, the next thing. Some of Hugh's Catholic friends are summoned, most of whom are attached to a sect who gather to dress up in medieval costumes and are in sympathy with a French cleric who appears in blurry photographs wearing sunglasses, smiling enigmatically.
Oh, now, who's that?
That was that French extreme Catholic, right-wing Catholic cleric.
He was.
Was he Lefebvre?
Lefebvre, yes, but they weren't interested in that.
No, I know, but I'm just saying as part of the picture. That and Ashley, I seem to remember, started... He would wear something to do with the Knights of St. John of the Cross or something. Like, wouldn't he gather at these meetings and wear these...
It was a small confraternity run by one of the masters of a Catholic boarding school. I can't remember what it. It was a kind of hobby of this bloke. Who taught French at. At Worth Abbey, that's right.
Okay.
And he had sort of traditional interests and medieval sort of chivalric,
yes,
stroke Catholic notions.
Yeah.
And he formed a small sort of chapter. I didn't join it.
Okay. All right.
Went to a couple of their meetings, you know.
Yeah.
Okay,
then one evening, Hugh came in and announced that his mother had died.
Yeah, well, that's true, yes.
Sometime later, he casually mentioned that he had been left some money.
Right.
Yeah. Hugh arrived at the dining room clad in black leather, now the proud owner of a vintage Norton motorcycle.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you remember that?
That was a disaster, actually. I bought it from a chap who'd rebuilt it as a hobby, and it turned out that he didn't really know what he was doing.
Oh,
because it quite soon needed to be looked at, and things went wrong with it, and I eventually sold it. You know.
I remember. It was a very nice looking thing.
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and.
Do you remember what year it was? How old was it?
I think it was probably 1948 or something. Oh, no, well, I don't know. Maybe mid-50s.
Okay.
It was a Norton International.
Right. Okay. He then bought an obscure three-wheeled car from a dealer in Birmingham, which he fitted with a petrol-burning heater. As he drove along the embankment, followed by the police, the car caught fire.
No, it didn't, William. It didn't.
You told me it did. There was a chase down the embankment.
No, you're making that up.
I'm not. You've told me this. I wouldn't make this up. You had a petrol-burning heater in the back.
Yeah, I got that from Morris.
Yeah.
Which was actually extremely effective, you know. I mean, it was the sort of thing that... what did they used to use it in? I was told by somebody else that who knew a bit about it, that it was fitted into our RAF cargo plane.
Right.
and it did it used to catch fire.
Exactly.
And so the air crew just disconnected all the wires. You know, they'd rather be frozen stiff than in a plane.
But you had it in a car that was the size of a Reliant Robin.
Yeah, no, I did. Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, it could be very cold in winter.
Okay.
And even with the hood up, you know, it was just a.
Yeah.
It wasn't a Robin. It was actually quite a good car.
No, I know it wasn't a Robin, but it was the size of a Robin. I think I can't remember what it was now, but.
Yeah, it was a Bristol. No, sorry, not a Bristol.
It was a Bond.
It was a.
Bond.
No. A Barclay.
Oh yes, a Barclay.
B-60.
Okay.
And so they had a series of three wheelers. They also had some four-wheelers, and the four-wheelers, now I'm not sure what they, which model was used for competition work, but one of them, I think it was probably a four-wheeler, was souped up and won a race. It was an Italian motor race or something.
Okay.
I mean, they would have...
But you were chased along the embankment by the police. I know that, because you and David were doing about 70 down the embankment in this thing.
No, it didn't. Well, it used to do about 70, actually.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, yeah.
Yep.
No, I wouldn't have gone at that speed, William.
Well, I'm going by
not
what
along
you...
along the embankment.
You told me
it. It would get up to 80 on a motorway.
Right.
And you could keep... Well, that was because it was a souped-up model with a mini engine, but the power to weight ratio was so good that those that had the front end mini conversion were quite fast, and mine wasn't as fast as others, which had been fitted with Mini Cooper engines.
Okay.
And were especially fast.
I'm going to stop you there.
Or more.
We've got to move on.
Yeah.
In passing, Sandra told Hugh that her favourite car was a Bristol. Hugh bought a Bristol for an undisclosed figure. We never saw the Bristol. It ended up in a field in Suffolk.
Yeah, you're right. I did know about them.
I know you did.
It was interesting that she knew about them as well.
Yes.
No, I thought it would be quite good. Well, for various reasons, but I ran out of money. I mean, it costs so much to restore vehicles.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I had something else restored by somebody else.
Yeah.
Who just made a bull's up of it.
Okay.
Whereas the Bristol project was a good project, and it was put in the hands of a
don't name him.
No, a very good mechanic who gave me an estimate of what the work would cost.
Yeah.
He did all the work within the estimated cost.
Yeah.
Which involved fitting a straight six BMW engine.
I know.
In place of
the, but it ended up in a field in Suffolk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Hugh bought another motorcycle and decided that it needed a bucket fairing.
I bought the motorbike. I didn't want the bucket fairing.
I
didn't want it. The reason why that fairing was fitted was because the guy who'd I'd entrusted the bike, which was my old motorbike, which I had for about 10 years, I gave it to him to do up, to restore.
Yeah.
And I wanted certain modifications done to it, which Morris was involved with. So I could use his heated clothing.
Yes. but it seems like the motorcycle became unstable and wasn't safe to ride.
Well, actually, it was that's probably how it would have been if I'd ever written it, but the job was never finished.
Right.
Because the guy, he bullshitted me about how it should be restored.
Yeah.
I had worked out how I wanted it done. Worked out in great detail, but he thought he had better ideas.
Okay.
Which required the fitting of the bloody fairing.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move on. We've
got
several more statements.
Right.
Hugh was now living at Mary Jones House, a warden-controlled block of flats in the shadow of Canary Wharf.
Yes.
Do we agree on that?
Yes, of course.
Okay. A Honda moped was modified by Morris so that the fiberglass box behind the rider contained a car battery for powering heated clothing. The moped was parked outside the wooden entrance porch to the block, within a few yards of the remains of the three-wheeled car, when locals decided to set fire to it, badly charring the porch and destroying the moped.
Yeah, but it hadn't had any work done on it by Morris, William.
No, but it had a box fitted so that it could take his batteries, didn't it?
No, it didn't.
You had to have heated clothing. You had to have a battery on the back of the moped.
But I wouldn't have used the heated clothing on the Honda.
Right. This is becoming like one of those court cases where nobody agrees on anything. It's like a sort of. It's you. This I've
no,
got.
To, no, I can remember. It was just a standard Honda. You wouldn't have. There would have been no point in buggering that about.
So what did you have the heated clothing for then? I could have sworn you had a battery on the back of this moped.
No. The heated clothing was to use with my BSA, right, which I was having restored.
Yeah. So why did the locals set fire to the moped?
It's just
vandalism.
Local vandalism.
Okay. All right. As the inheritance ran out, each vehicle was sold for a substantial loss.
Right. Well. Yeah, I suppose it. Nothing. The guy who was working on my motorbike, and who was not following my perfectly practical suggestions about how it should be, how the work should be done. I don't know what he did with my bike, but I refused to carry on paying him because he just messed it up.
Okay.
And it was costing more and more than it should have done.
Yeah.
So I suppose he just, I don't know, he probably claimed it as rightfully his because he'd done the work that which I wasn't paying him for. And I suppose he just dismantled it or sold it or something.
Okay. Next point.
Yeah, he tried to take me to court to get money that he claimed I still owed him.
Yeah.
But that just petered out.
Okay. Hugh invented a trouser coat.
Yeah, that was supposed to be and it would have probably worked. At least part of it would have done.
Yeah.
That was just supposed to be a protective piece of clothing for motorcyclists and other people.
So what was the difference about it? Can you just give me a précis of what...
Well, it was supposed to be a... It would have looked... If I'd finished it off, it would have looked like a straightforward, nicely styled... raincoat. Well, like a sort of Burberry, you know, a sort of trench coat, if you like.
Yeah.
Which could be converted very quickly into an overall, the sort of leggings, trousers, and a sort of jacket that you could wear on a motorbike.
Yeah.
Any sort of outdoor. A sort of walking around or riding on a motorbike or even on a horse, I suppose.
So it's a kind of hybrid garment then?
Something, yes, it was, yes.
Something that changed into something else?
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
But it never quite got finished, did it?
No, because I ran out of money with that as well. But that did have some good points. It was rather over-ambitious, and I could still finish it. And finishing it wouldn't be difficult or terribly expensive. And the core of the idea, which I'm not going to mention, would have made it a unique garment, with all which would have been very useful in all sorts of contexts. But I'm not going to say any more about it because in one sentence or less, I could give away the essential secret, and somebody could sort of run with it and make a lot of money. That would be possible.
Well, that leads on nicely.
If the idea is good enough, and if it's sort of carried through successfully.
Yes. So that leads nicely on to what is basically my last statement here, which is, for the last 10 years, Hugh has been obsessed with a machine for which he has made numerous diagrams. He calls it my invention. Occasionally, he becomes agitated and impatient about its progress. Nobody will listen to him. And if the machine is ever made, the powers that be will certainly want to destroy it and have Hugh vanished as the invention, as the invention will undermine the oil economy, rendering conventional machinery obsolete.
Right.
Now, this, if you want to read out, that's the end of my statements.
Right.
You can now, we can either just carry on talking if you want, or you could now read out you have some sort of prepared document, I think, which you're welcome to read out on air if you want to.
Yeah, well, I won't bother to read this, which I've got ready, because it's really longer than it needs to be. But I have been working on a project which requires the input of a mechanical engineering student, or probably a student, because I could afford to pay a student, but not somebody who's graduated. I could read this out, but
yeah, you will make a start.
I don't really know. Well, I will. All right then. Well,
go
I will.
Yep.
Because I went to the trouble of writing it all out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to say what this is. If anybody becomes responds to this advertisement, then the idea is that the person would, on studying what I have to offer here, be able to analyse it so as to see if it would work or not, and just by listening to what I have to say and showing him my drawings, he would see what it's supposed to do.
But it could be a she, couldn't it?
That,
Hugh, can you hear me?
He's understood what I've said to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carry on. I was just going to say it could be a he or it could be a she, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, look, I'll read it out because... All right. Well, shall I start reading this now, then?
Definitely. Absolutely. That's fine.
All right, then. Okay. Right. Well, it's about 3 pages, but it only takes about 2 minutes to read it out.
Take as long as you like.
Yeah. And this is... I mean, you've probably gathered from what William said that that I'm a sort of would-be inventor. And it's true that I have been working on various things over the years, and it takes so long to get anywhere. The thing is, I've probably I probably can go so far as to say that I've got the mechanical mindedness of an averagely good garage mechanic, nothing more. But maybe I've had good ideas. Now, I'm not making any claims about anything. I just have proposals for various things, and one of my projects does need the input of a suitable student, probably somewhere in London at one of the universities or colleges of further education. It would probably be better. Ideally, I would have a student who has been sponsored by the Whitworth Society. This is something that I've probably been to various universities to get the involvement of the mechanical engineering department or a student or whatever, or all in vain. And what I encounter is disingenuousness. Things are said to me that you can't square what is said by one person with what is said by somebody else elsewhere. What it is, they just don't want to know, you see. One way of putting you off is by saying, well, look, this would take about 2 weeks to work through, to analyse, and that would cost about 20,000 quid. another engineering academic at Oxford University said I didn't see her, but I wrote to her and sent her my drawings. And she said, after I'd heard nothing from her, I phoned her back. And what happened? I think she wrote to me.
Hugh, can I interrupt a second?
Yes, I'll just tell you this as a sort of contrast to the sort of bullshitting that you get from one lot of people.
Yeah. Hugh, try not to
can sometimes get from other people.
Hugh?
Yes?
Try not to use expletives, please.
Sorry.
That's all right. It's before a certain hour.
Was I using...
Yes. Now, have you started your...
What did I use then?
Bullshit.
Oh, come on, William. That's very mild.
Yes, it's the radio. I can't help it.
Anyway.
Have you started...
No, she said to me...
Listen to me. Hugh?
Yeah?
Have you started the statement yet?
No, I haven't. Let me just finish this point.
Okay.
And then I'll go on to it, right?
Right.
She said to me about what she does and what takes up her time. She said to me, look, I'm trying to hold down two jobs here. Your thing would require half a day's work, right?
Yeah.
That, in contrast to what other people say, where it would take 2 weeks of university time.
Yeah, no, this...
Which would cost £1,000.
Yeah, you should read the statement.
£10,000. Then somebody else said £15,000.
Okay.
Anyway, it wouldn't cost anything, Arcus. Most of the work could even be done by a sixth former who's doing A-level maths.
All right, well...
Not that complicated.
If you start the statement...
All that I can do. Anyway, okay, I'll start this... right, well, all this has been leading up to this, so let's hope it's going to be worthwhile. I hope so. Somebody will get a bit of cash, which will be... and it's an interesting project, which you will find out about when you contact me, if you do. So... And this is what I've written down, which I'll be reading from. An advanced mechanical engineering student is required to do mathematical analyses of mechanical devices to prove whether they will work or not. The rate of pay will be somewhere around £12 to £15 per hour, plus travelling expenses within reason. The work has to be done at the inventor's home or at the home of one or other of obliging friends or acquaintances of his in East London. The Docklands Light Railway is convenient. Right, for this. No, I'm quite near to a station. Okay, the student would need to have a natural flair for mechanical engineering design, whose ideal job after university would be to work on the design of engines, stroke, transmissions, stroke, suspension systems, and such like. The student, he or she, would need to have a thorough grounding in the theory of machines. By the way, I'll just interrupt myself to say I'm going to finish off what I started to say but forgot to carry on with about the Whitworth Society. Anyway, now I'll resume this. The student, he or she, would need to have a thorough grounding in the theory of machines, specifically vector analysis, to do with kinematic chains, systems of linkages, and various arrangements of interconnected levers. Also needed are the maths to do with gear ratios and force magnification or reduction that can be achieved using systems of levers that are both conventional and also novel. It would be appreciated if the student could do the calculations using somewhat old-fashioned and elementary nomenclature and methods without recourse to trigonometry, which I'll just say I did once learn something about. I was able to use it, but I've forgotten it all. As used to be used in teaching these things in the introductory courses in technical colleges quite a long time ago, probably. What used to be referred to as graphical methods. This would enable me, the would-be inventor, to more easily understand the calculations, as I have not had any training in this. But I do understand the most elementary theory about how levers work. Right, now that's... okay, the next page. Almost as important as the foregoing, is the ability to do at least passably good freehand drawings and diagrams of these mechanisms, following my descriptions of them from my thumbnail sketches, and a small number of first-stage mock-ups and partially working models made of strips of wood, etc., which, while amateurish, do nevertheless show, and with a reasonable degree of accuracy, the directions of force and force interactions that must occur if the devices are to work satisfactorily. It will almost certainly be seen that standard methods of analysis will apply. While these devices are quite novel, and as a collection of mechanisms are all quite different, they nevertheless have in common characteristics that are more to be seen in systems of statics, such as would be found in structural engineering, than in dynamic systems. Right. That is, where there is stasis rather than movement. This is where the secret lies. How can a system of stasis, consisting of interconnected parts, also be a dynamic system? Well, if what I am trying to do is possible, this is essential. Here is a clue, although it doesn't tell you very much, as I mustn't give too much away at this stage. If a building is collapsing, then during its collapse, as its various parts fall out of alignment, but momentarily at least remain connected, until the overwhelming stresses and strains break everything apart, that building is moving, even though it wasn't meant to. And each part acts on other parts as a dynamic system. This is the closest analogy that I can use that may give a very vague idea of what I'm trying to achieve, and for a very good purpose, as you will see. Finally, please study this quotation of Tolstoy from his letters, probably. This is extremely relevant. Okay, and then I must mention what I was about to say about the Whitworth Society, and also I've got a short quote from Richard Feynman, the well-known physicist. physicist. Anyway, this is Tolstoy, right? I know that most men, not only those considered clever, but even those who are clever and capable of understanding the most difficult scientific, mathematical, or philosophic problems, can seldom discern even the simplest and most obvious truth, if it be such as obliges them to admit the falsity of conclusions they have formed, perhaps with much difficulty, conclusions of which they are proud, which they have taught to others, and on which they have built their lives. That's Tolstoy writing, presumably, in 1898. Right, now, this project concerns energy. Just to put you off completely, but not quite, and if you think I'm not making any sense at all, that's a good idea. I'm glad of that, because you're not meant to. But this device, you can't say that it doesn't have anything to do with dynamometer design, right? Dynamometers are simply devices that are used to gauge the power output of engines. So this is not completely unconnected with dynamometers and what dynamometers are supposed to do. And you will see what I mean if you work with me to in collaboration. You'll see what I'm talking about. But it's a sort of back-to-front thing. That's supposed to put you off. I should think, but possibly they are quite interesting to some people. But anyway, I'm not going to say any more about that right now. About the Whitworth Society, probably a fair number of the engineering lecturers that I saw over the last 15 years at their various universities, and I was even attached to a university in the London area for a couple of years, supposedly working for a master's degree, using my project as the material. But anyway, that didn't get anywhere, and I was sort of misinformed by the people who were that petered out. Why am I mentioning that? Well, they were probably all members of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, I should think.
The other day, Hugh, you used the analogy of a railway track.
Yes. Right, well, okay, yes, thanks for reminding me, William. Right, well, now what I may have done over the last couple of years, that certain things have dawned on me that may be possible. I've simplified this mechanism very greatly. When I first thought of it, it was quite a lot more complicated, but it's much simpler now, and I've got several versions of it. They are really quite simple, but something quite simple can have quite a lot of sort of, it requires, you've got to say a lot more about it than you might think in order to say everything about it that is relevant, so that you've described it fully. Yet it could be a very simple device. And that's how I think some of these devices they've sort of evolved into quite simple devices. And William has seen them, although I don't want William to say anything more about what he's seen than what I have. right, now, if I could get a student who's working for a male or female, who's working for a master's degree or possibly even a doctorate, was sponsored by the Whitworth Society, then that would be ideal, because those students have, I believe, got to complete 2 years of an apprenticeship which means that they don't only learn theory of engineering, they also learn how to make things, how to do machining, how to do fitting.
Hugh?
Fitting may not seem to be anything terribly interesting, but the most accomplished workshop engineers are, I believe, fitters.
Hugh?
Do everything by hand. Anyway, sorry. So if you're a, if there's any...
Don't forget the railway line.
No. Right, I'll get on to that next. If there's a Whitworth Society student, you'd be ideal, I think. If you have done what at least used to be the conventional sort of course leading from training in a machine shop to be a precision machinist and other things, as well as drawing office work and such like, before going on to university.
Right. We've got 9 minutes to talk about the railway line.
Oh, right. Well, yes. Thanks for bringing me back to that point. it may be possible to talk about more than one mode of motion. Now, movement is movement, but there may be more than one kind of movement. What I will say about that, I know there's more than one kind of movement. There's circular movement, there's reciprocating movement, and combinations of all various. But one can say that however a piece of mechanism moves, or the various separate parts that make up that mechanism, nevertheless, whether those parts are cams or rods or reciprocating devices or whatever, springs, there's something about them that is common to all, even though they all move in different ways. So you could say that that's mode A. Now, there's another mode of motion, which you could perhaps say is mode B, which doesn't usually occur in dynamic systems, but certainly does in mine. Now, I can illustrate this by talking about a train moving along a track. Right, now, the train is moving in relation to the Earth. The Earth is stationary and the train is moving along it, on its railway lines. Now, just like a person who is walking along the pavement. There is relative movement between the two parts, the pavement or the person walking over it, the train moving along its track, right? The Earth is stationary, the train is moving. And in all mechanical systems, pieces of machinery or whatever, there is relative movement between the parts. Now, there's also something else. Now, if you consider that train, you've got an engine that pulls a load, carriages or trucks or whatever. And you could say that the engine is moving in a different way from the rest of the train, because the engine is there is no relative movement between the engine and what it's pulling. And we're not considering sort of swaying from side to side or whatever, you know. I mean, as the train moves along the track, the carriages or trucks move with it. There is no relative movement. that may seem a very sort of banal and obvious thing to say, that I haven't really said anything. It's a distinction, but it's just a sort of verbal distinction. You know, it doesn't really mean anything. It wouldn't be useful. Well, that is that's not the case with my mechanisms. I am using parts in one of those modes that work in one of those modes, and in fact, both of them. Now, you've got to have both modes in order to possibly, but have both modes in order to have any kind of functioning at all. But one of those modes is not it does not characterize the functioning of machinery at all now. If you think of anything, any piece of machinery, it doesn't it doesn't have both modes of working.
Hugh.
Yeah.
We've got about.
No, I'm not sort of putting this very well.
No, but we've only got about 4 minutes left.
Okay. Yeah.
Suffice it to say that you are prepared to pay someone.
Oh yes.
To
it wouldn't be a lot, but it would be something like sort of 10 to 15 quid an hour.
Yeah.
What I will say is that if this if this project is any good and my thinking is sound and these various devices would work, then the person would have a share in whatever
in your invention.
Well, yes.
Okay.
And it's right now. I'll just say that this mechanism it would be useful for one of the things that it would be useful for is a report was produced for the Institution of Mechanical Engineers by a certain Dr. Tim Fox. I think it was Tim Fox, who was considering the effects of forthcoming climate change and what could be done, what would be possible and all the rest of it, and what would need to be done. And in the course of one thing that he referred to was that in India, for example, 40% of the food that is produced is currently spoilt and is made unfit for human consumption because the warehousing of it is unsatisfactory in that there are not refrigeration plants in widespread use to keep the produce in good condition. That's 40%, I think he said, wrote.
So how does your invention help that?
Because it would change that. None of the food produced would deteriorate because it would be possible, because of my invention, for there to be widespread use of refrigeration plants. Now, I don't say why. I haven't invented any kind of refrigeration device, but something that refrigeration technology requires.
Okay.
So the millions upon millions of people in India who die, whose children are brought up malnourished and never achieve their full potential because their brains don't develop, because of my invention, again, if it would work, and I'm not claiming that it would, all I have are proposals for mechanical devices. I'm not saying that any of them would work, because I haven't got the skill to work it out myself. I need a suitable operator. All right. Also, other things. I'll just say that, but it would be anybody interested in climate change and what can be done about it would find this interesting, because it would be possible to...